Crime, Wine, and Chaos contains adult language and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
All aboard the struggle bus, Chaos Kids. I'm Naomi.
I'm Amber. I'm the driver. And this is Crime, Wine, and Chaos. Oh my God.
That one just came to me, right?
Yeah, it's so true. The wheels on this bus ain't going round and round today.
No, I think we're short a couple of wheels on the bus, actually.
God, just park me at the bus barn and leave me there.
Maybe you'll get a good nap in the back, just like on that back bench.
That's all I want is to nap.
I know, sister. So that's how you're doing.
Otherwise, things are great. How are you? God.
I mean, you know, I don't know, sister. I don't know. You know what? This is legit post Chaos Kids Club virtual wine night, which we said had happened in our last episode, but hadn't actually happened yet. Now it's actually happened.
Yes.
And it was so great.
It really was.
Wasn't it fantastic?
Mm-hmm. Those are our people.
These are our people. We know everyone listening is our people, but you gotta get in on the Chaos Kids Club. Our virtual wine night was so much fun. We had such a good time. Amber made me cry like she always does.
Sorry. I was like extra chatty. You know, it was the wine.
You know what? I loved it. No, do not apologize. Okay. No, it was amazing. And we had just a great group and we talked about all kinds of things. And some of the Chaos Kids were making connections with each other.
I loved that.
It was beautiful. It was really beautiful. You know what? Crime, Wine, and Chaos, bringing Chaos Kids Club members together. So that was awesome.
It was amazing.
What else is going on?
Oh, well, I finished my vision board. It's next to me. You can't see it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You might have to snap a pic and post that in the Facebook group.
Yeah. So that was amazing. And I hung it up today. So, you know, we'll
because you got to have goals, you know,
you've got to have goals. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, mine is the fall of empire, but you know, whatever your goal is, I support you.
Everyone
you know?
Has their path. Yeah.
That's right. That's exactly right.
My God.
What are you drinking?
Thank you for asking. You know, tonight I actually just have some water because I'm not feeling very good.
Oh, sister, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's okay. That's okay. And you're drinking water also.
As per usual, you know me. As per usual, I'm a real party animal over here.
Getting wild. Well, you know what?
Says that our dad is a real
male sex machine.
What's that from? Is that from The Great Outdoors?
Kindergarten Cop.
Oh, kindergarten. Mm-hmm. Not a tuma.
Mm-hmm. My dad's a gynecologist and he looks at vaginas all day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
God. Anyway, sister.
Yeah.
I have this feeling you're going to tell me a bummer story.
It's so bad.
Oh my God. You know what sucks about that?
Today's not the day. What? Yours is bad too? Okay. All right.
It's a triple D, guys. It's a double Debbie Downer today. Okay. Sorry. You know what? We were at the virtual wine night and we were like, does anybody have any questions? Anybody want to ask us anything? And one of the gals goes, you guys have been doing some real heavy episodes lately. Do you have any plans to do any chaos stories that are like, and I was like, I've got the one that dropped this week, right? With Richard McGuire at Discovery Park, which was admittedly lighthearted and hilarious. But sorry, guys, we're going back into the depths. Apologies, guys. Apologies.
And I'm a big fat liar because I said that I would find something funny. And then I saw this case and I was like, this is horrific and devastating. And here we are.
Okay.
So this is a crier. So the last time I saw you, I made you cry. This is trending. I'm really sorry. God, I suck.
Hashtag trending.
Hashtag Amber trending.
makes me cry. You know what? Oh, let's be real though. Like, I'm a crier. Okay. I'm a crier.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Okay. Here we go.
Well, this one, I don't know. I think it's kind of a well-known case. Maybe not. Have you heard of the case called the Ding Dong Ditch case?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, I'm going to tell you about it. So it's January 19th, 2020 in Corona, California. And six teenage boys who were all very good friends were hanging out at 16-year-old Daniel Hawkins' house. They were celebrating one of the birthdays and just having like innocent good fun. So they ate junk food, played football in the street. All six of them were having a sleepover at Daniel's that night.
God bless Daniel's parents. I know. And this is starting to sound familiar.
Uh-oh. Okay. So it was a Sunday night, but the following day was Martin Luther King Day, so they had no school. In the group were two Joshes, ages 13 and 14. Daniel, Drake, and Jacob were all 16. Jake was the birthday boy, and the oldest was 18-year-old Sergio. Jacob and one of the Joshes were brothers, and Daniel and the other Josh were brothers.
Okay.
And all six of them are like besties together.
Okay.
So that evening, they're playing football in the street, eating junk food, all the things. And then later on in the evening, they started playing a game that was sort of like hot potato. So they stood in a circle and passed around a ball, and they used a timer on one of their cell phones. And whoever was touching the ball last when the timer went off had to complete a dare.
Okay.
So the dares were like innocent good fun, like drinking a spoonful of hot sauce, or, you know, at one point they went in and like made some nasty concoction of like every condiment in the fridge and someone had to eat that.
Classic.
So, yeah. So during this round, 14-year-old Joshua Ivascu lost the round and his friends gave him two options. He could either jump into the neighbor's pool or go to a house and do a ding dong ditch.
Okay.
And Joshua chose to do the ding dong ditch. And so all of the boys jumped into Sergio's Prius. Six people in a Prius. And it's just after 10 p.m. Oh my God,
six boys in a Prius. Okay.
You remember being that age. Like, we'll make it work.
Yeah, there's like two people in the passenger seat and up front. Mm-hmm. And there's like three in the back just jammed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they're all squished and they're pretty good. Some of the boys had no shoes on because they planned on just like finding a house down the street, do the prank, and then head back to Daniel's, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they picked a house at random. And one of the boys said it was because this house had cool outdoor lights on it that changed colors.
Okay.
That was it. The house was at 10176 Majosca Summit Road. So Sergio parked on the street a few feet away and Josh Ivascu hopped out, and Josh's older brother, Jacob, used his cell phone to record a video of Josh, you know, walking up to the front door. So the other five stayed in the car and they're laughing, and Josh walks up to the front door and he even turns around and like gives a thumbs up to the camera. And when he got to the front door, he knocked really lightly and his friends were like laughing and telling him like, no, you need to ring the bell. You need to ring the bell, whatever. Right. So he rings the bell, the door opens and Josh runs back to the car laughing. And just before he hops in the car, he turns around and moons the guy. And okay. Then they get in the car and drive off.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But what these boys didn't know is that they very much picked the wrong house to do this to.
Oh,
because,
no.
Yeah. The man who lived at this house was an angry alcoholic prick. So they're making their way back to Daniel's place, which is just a few blocks up the road, when a white Infiniti suddenly came right up on their ass. And the driver of the Infiniti was flashing their high beams and like swerving all over the road behind them. And as he gets really close to the bumper, the boys in the back of the Prius look out the back window and they tell Sergio that the driver of the Infiniti is the guy whose house they were just at.
Mm-hmm.
So he speeds up and he's trying to get away, but the Infiniti starts ramming into the back of his car.
Jesus Christ.
Yes. Yeah. So at this point, the boys are scared, obviously.
Yeah, I'm scared.
Mm-hmm. Then the Infinity driver pulls up alongside them and starts ramming into the side of Sergio's car.
What the fuck is going on?
This guy is fucking insane. Unhinged.
This is insane behavior.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So Sergio slams on the brakes and like makes a U-ey really quick and starts heading in the opposite direction of Daniel's house. And one of his friends in the car thought that maybe if they could make it to the freeway, they would lose him. But
in a Prius,
I know. Yeah.
In a Prius with six kids in it.
I know. Also with, you know, a very inexperienced driver, minimum of 2 years he's been driving, right?
Right.
Or maximum of 2 years, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. So the Infiniti turns around and right on their ass again. So rather than try to make it to the freeway, Sergio turned onto a residential street into a neighborhood that he was familiar with because they had another friend that lived there. And he's hoping that he could just lose this guy in the neighborhood.
Okay.
So Sergio turned onto Mescal Canyon Road. He's going around 60 miles an hour and the Infiniti is still right behind them. So he speeds up. And at this point, Sergio is going 99 miles an hour when the Infiniti rams into the back of them, sending the boys off the road and into a tree.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. So it's 10:28 p.m. and witnesses say that they saw the white Infiniti flee the scene with his front bumper dragging along the road. So Sergio smashed into the windshield and blacked out. When fire and EMS arrived, they found the Prius wedged between the tree and a telephone pole, and the car was completely mangled. The passenger side of the car and the roof were missing, and witnesses said that it looked like a jagged lid from a partially opened can.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. So they used the jaws of life to start prying back the metal and try to reach the boys inside. Jacob, who was the birthday boy, was dead at the scene.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. I know. The other five were rushed to the hospital, and 16-year-old Daniel and 16-year-old Drake were pronounced dead at the hospital. I know. They're so cute, too. They just look like little boys. I mean, ding dong ditch. They're just playing a fucking game. So the police are able to follow the trail of fluid left behind on the road. And they arrive at the Ding Dong Ditch house about 30 minutes after the accident. They found the Infiniti parked on the street a few houses down with the entire front bumper missing. They banged on the door, but this guy refused to come out. And eventually law enforcement had the entire home surrounded and they're yelling for this guy to come out. So several hours later, around 2:15 a.m., the suspect from inside the house called 911. This guy... He identified himself. Yeah, he calls 911. Oh, just wait. He calls 911. This guy is 42-year-old Anurag Chandra. And he told the dispatcher there was a disturbance outside of his home. People are banging on his door and he could see flashlights.
What?
Mm-hmm. No.
What?
He's full of shit. This guy is full of shit. The dispatcher was like, yeah, that's the police and they're trying to arrest you. You need to go outside.
Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine being the person who takes that call?
No. Okay, but you know what? Something sort of similar happened to me. Not this similar. Remember when someone tried to break into my house?
In Kirkland?
Yeah. And I called 911 and I was talking to the dispatcher and she was staying on the phone with me until the police got there. And at one point I was like, oh my God, I see lights in my yard. And she's like, those are the officers. And I was like, oh.
You asked for them.
There's two men on my lawn with lights. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
God, Amber. I was just shaken. So, okay. So he hangs up on the dispatcher, and about half an hour later, he came outside with his hands in the air and he's taken into custody.
Okay.
Yeah. When he goes through the booking, authorities learned that they know this guy because just a few weeks prior, he was booked in for misdemeanor battery on his spouse and child endangerment against his daughter.
Oh my God.
This guy's a piece of shit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He ended up taking a guilty plea on both of those charges and was released with credit for time served. So he had been out of custody for like a couple of weeks.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other three boys did end up making a full recovery. The driver, Sergio, had several broken vertebrae. 13-year-old Josh and 14-year-old Josh suffered broken bones, fractured skull, and dislocated shoulder.
Jesus.
I know. On January 23rd, 2022, Chandra had his arraignment. And per his lawyer's advice, he chose not to enter a plea that day. The prosecutor gave an interview to the press outside the courtroom and said, quote, "It's just beyond what someone's reaction should be to someone ringing your doorbell and running away."
Yeah, it's beyond.
It's fucking beyond.
What was the charge they brought against him? Did they give him manslaughter or murder?
Murder.
Mm-hmm. Three counts.
Mm-hmm. Three counts.
Wow.
Yeah. So Daniel was a student at Santiago High and a star football player. His friends, Drake and Josh, who were brothers, attended Centennial High just a few miles up the road. And Jacob attended Woodcrest Christian High School. And even though they all went to different schools, they had met at church in a youth group and they had been inseparable since they were little.
Oh,
I know. The tree that the boys hit that evening was turned into a memorial. Each boy had their own private funeral, but on Wednesday, January 29th, public services were held in a church theater at the same church where all six went to youth group together. These sweet baby boys. Okay, so in January of 2022, the defense filed a motion to have the charges reduced to manslaughter, stating that his client didn't mean to kill the boys, but the judge denied the motion.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. His murder trial was scheduled for April 2023.
Oh.
Yeah, this is pretty recent. At the trial, the tape of his interrogation that night was played, and he had told police that the teen who was on his front porch was a sex offender, and that he chased him down to protect his family, and that he only wanted to verbally confront him because he mooned him. He's a sex offender.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was also learned at trial that that evening he had consumed 12 beers. This guy. They also played a recorded phone call that he had made while he was in jail. And on that call, he had a completely different story. He said that someone knocked on his door that night, but that he had left his house to go fill his gas tank and wash his car. And then someone threw a rock at his car. And then a Prius just came out of nowhere and crashed into a tree by itself.
What?
He said he just drove home after that because he didn't have his cell phone on him to call 911 to help them.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then at trial, he testified that he was frustrated because he was supposed to be up the next day at 5 a.m. for work. And so, you know, he didn't appreciate the ding-dong ditch, but he didn't intentionally cause the crash.
Okay.
Yeah, he's ramming into their car.
Chasing them down. They're going 100 miles an hour and he is not letting up.
Mm-mm. No.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the crash analysis data collected from the site told a different story. The prosecutor said that he did, in fact, use his car as a deadly weapon to commit premeditated murder. The jury also saw the cell phone video that was taken of Joshua giving his friends the thumbs up as he walked up to the front door.
Oh,
so sad. So the jury ended up finding Chandra guilty on all counts. In July of 2023, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Wow. Two of the survivors now live together. They're roommates and all have been called walking miracles, and they are doing their best to move on.
I can't even imagine.
No.
You're just out having a fun night. I mean, that is literally the plot of like at more than one like thriller slash horror movies. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Just like teenagers out having a good time being picked off or murdered or terrorized by some crazed fucking asshole.
Crazed fucking asshole. And, you know, how many times have we done stories where it's like you get that many teenage boys together and they're the ones doing something terrible? These were right? just like good, wholesome kids.
Right.
Like they're eating junk food and having a sleepover. You know what?
Oh, my God.
I could.
Amber.
I'm sorry. Who the hell gets that fucking unhinged at kids?
Anyone, really. I mean,
yeah. What are you doing?
Like he got
ramming them?
He like put his shoes on, got his keys, got in his car, and like raced to track these kids down.
I know.
What are we doing? Like what?
I know.
Oh my God. And of course he's like has a history of domestic violence, you know?
Mm-hmm. Child abuse. Yeah. Piece of shit.
Well, thanks for that, I guess.
I'm sorry, sister. You're welcome.
It's fine. Whatever. Moving on to my chaos bummer. Oh. That's not really going to help us, but I mean, it's a nice try.
Thank you.
I'm going to tell you about the Bhopal disaster. Have you ever heard about this?
No.
Okay. So Bhopal is a city in central India. It's just north of the Vindhya mountain ranges, and it is the capital of the state of Madhya Pradesh. It is known as the City of Lakes because of its many natural and man-made lakes, and with a population of over 1.7 million people, it is now one of the greenest cities in India.
Ooh.
I read somewhere, I didn't put it in here, but I read somewhere that they had like been included in some initiative, like some global initiative where like, you know, 20 or 30 cities had been picked for like green initiatives and like, like high tech green initiatives. And so they were on that list and they've been, you know, upgraded.
Cool.
But back in 1984, Bhopal's population was much smaller with 850,000 people. Years prior to that, in 1969, Union Carbide set up a separate company in partnership with Indian-controlled banks and called it Union Carbide India Limited, or UCIL.
Okay.
And they built a factory. The factory was built to produce a pesticide called Sevin, spelled S-E-V-I-N, which was Union Carbide's brand name for Carbaryl. This process to make Carbaryl used another chemical compound called methyl isocyanate, or otherwise referred to as MIC. And this was an intermediate to get to Carbaryl. So the process involved this other chemical, methylamine, reacting with phosgene to form the methyl isocyanate. So they had to make the MIC, right? Mm-hmm. And then the MIC is used to make the Carbaryl. And I know my eyes are also glossing over, Amber, because I am not a chemist. Suffice it to say that in order to make this pesticide, there were multiple gases that had to be mixed together in a series of processes to get to the end result. Okay.
Okay. So it's basically a meth lab.
Basically.
Okay.
There were other big companies producing Carbaryl without using this process, but it costs more to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 1980s, even though demand for pesticides was falling, the production continued at the same pace, which led to a bunch of unused MIC at the Bhopal plant.
Okay.
There were problems reported long before 1984. In 1976, two local trade unions had complained of pollution within the plant. Mm-hmm. In 1981, a worker in the plant accidentally got splashed with phosgene, one of the chemicals that they used to make the MIC. He was carrying out routine maintenance on pipes inside the plant. He panicked And so he removed his gas mask and inhaled a whole bunch of the phosgene gas, and he died about 3 days later.
Oh my God. Wow.
It was just after this incident that journalist Raj Kumar Kaswani began investigating and publishing what he found in the Bhopal local paper, Rapat. That's the name of the paper. He wrote in one of his pieces, quote, "Wake up, people of Bhopal. You are on the edge of a volcano."
Oh, shit.
And then just a year later, in January of 1982, a phosgene leak exposed 24 factory workers who all ended up in the hospital. And it turned out none of them had been required or even advised to wear protective equipment.
What?
Mm-hmm. A month later, in February of 82, another leak, this time of the MIC, affecting 18 workers. And then in August, still 1982, a chemical engineer came into contact with liquid MIC, which ended in him having burns over 30% of his body.
Oh my God. Did it like spill? How did, what in the world?
I don't know. And in October, again, still in 1982, there was another MIC leak. While trying to stop the leak, the MIC supervisor suffered severe chemical burns, and two other workers were severely exposed to the gases.
What is it leaking out of? Why does it keep leaking?
I don't know. Pipes?
Pipes that are just like shitty and have holes
not in them? Not maintained? I don't know. Oh,
God. Okay.
In 1983 and 1984, there were numerous leaks of a multitude of the chemicals in the plant, sometimes in combinations. So not just one, but like more than one would leak at a time. So the facility had, this is where it starts to get, they had three underground liquid storage tanks for the MIC, each tank with a capacity to hold up to 18,000 gallons. And in 1984, like I said before, the demand for these pesticides were dropping. So through 1984, the plant was filling up these underground tanks. Because remember, the MIC is part of the process to get to carbaryl.
Right.
So if they're not making carbaryl, they've got somewhere else. This MIC has to go somewhere else.
Okay. Real quick. Sorry. So it's all just being stored under them. Like they're all just sitting on dynamite, it sounds like. Why is it still being shipped to them when they have an abundance of it?
Well, I don't really understand all of the processes going okay. on here.
Okay.
Now you have questions for me that I don't have answers for.
Well, actually makes me feel a little bit better.
And the MIC isn't being shipped to them. The MIC is actually made, right? It's a multi-step process. So they have to okay. make the MIC and then they use the MIC to make the carbaryl. The MIC okay. is what they call an intermediate
okay.
Part of the process, meaning it's in the middle of that process.
Okay, sorry. That was the glazed over part of this story.
That's fine. Sorry. That's fine. We're all going to get there. We're all going to get there. So the plant's filling up these underground tanks, right? Now, safety regulations specified that no one tank should be filled more than 50% with liquid MIC. And each tank was pressurized with inert nitrogen gas. This pressurization allowed liquid MIC to be pumped out of each tank as needed, while keeping impurities and moisture out of the tanks. You remember when we talked about this kind of reminded me a little bit of the story of the Hindenburg. Remember when we yes. talked about how they had to keep it pure nitrogen and those things, and then they would pump more in there and keep it like super pressurized and tight so that like oxygen couldn't seep in and mix in yeah. there. Mm-hmm. Similar process, but with liquid MIC in these underground tanks where they're using the nitrogen basically to keep it pressurized so that nothing else is getting in there and it's just the liquid MIC. And then it also, that pressure is what makes it possible for them to then pump that liquid MIC out, right? Because yeah. there's enough pressure to do that. So in late October of 1984, one of the tanks was unable to effectively contain most of its nitrogen gas pressure. So it was like the liquid MIC couldn't be pumped out because they couldn't keep it pressurized. This tank at that point held about 42 tons of liquid MIC.
Oh God.
Right after this, the plant halted production of MIC and shut down parts of the plant for maintenance. One thing being repaired at this time was a corroded pipe on the plant's flare tower. We're learning a lot today. Flare tower is used in industrial plants primarily to burn off flammable gases released by safety valves during like unplanned overpressuring of plant equipment. It's a safety valve release. It's a way to like take the gas gets burned. So it's not just like emitting into the air. You're not just like throwing that gas up in the air. It's burning off through this tower. Right. And it's a release. It's a pressure release. It's a safety feature.
Okay.
In late November, production spun back up with the flare tower still rendered useless.
The safety feature is useless?
That one, yeah.
Okay.
The Carbaryl production was utilizing MIC from the other two tanks that were still working just fine. They weren't fucking with the tank that wasn't working. And by early December 1984, most of the plant's MIC-related safety systems were malfunctioning. And production lines were in poor condition. Mm-hmm. Also, several vent gas scrubbers had been out of service, along with the steam boiler that was supposed to clean the pipes.
Is everything in this plant not working, broken?
A lot of it.
Jeez, I would be so fucking nervous to be an employee there. Just walking around in a ticking time bomb.
Yeah.
Oh.
In the late evening hours of December 2nd, 1984, an attempt was being made to unclog a side pipe in the MIC storage tank that was not being used because of that lack of pressure problem. Mm-hmm. And it was believed that it was during this unclogging attempt that water made its way into the tank. Mm-hmm. This tank still held about 42 tons of MIC that had been there since late October. Mm-hmm. The water that seeped into the tank caused a chain reaction spurred on by contaminants, high ambient temperatures, and other factors such as iron from corroding pipes and pressure in that tank began to build.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. Two different senior refinery employees reading the pressure gauge assumed that the gauge was malfunctioning.
You know what? At this point, I would too, because everything in this place fucking malfunctions.
I literally wrote that as my next sentence, basically. Okay. Like, I get it. Yeah, I would. Yeah.
That's broken too.
Mm-hmm. It's broken. Everything's broken here.
God.
It's just a broken gauge.
Mm-hmm.
But within half an hour, around 11:30 p.m., factory workers in that area of the plant were feeling the effects of minor exposure to MIC gas and started looking for the leak. Mm-hmm. It was found about 15 minutes later and reported to the MIC supervisor on duty at the time. The decision was made to address the problem later, after the 12:15 a.m. tea break.
Oh, okay. No, I need a minute.
I'm just going down for you.
These people can feel the effects of being exposed to this nasty shit. And the supervisor is like, after my spot of tea.
That's right.
Oh, my God. I have no words.
Yep. In the meantime, employees were told to continue looking for leaks, and the problem was discussed by MIC area employees during their tea break. So, tea break is over. It's 12:40 a.m.
Tea break was a success. God damn it.
And now the reaction that had started in the tank has escalated to a critical state. The temperature inside the tank was off the scale and maxed out. The pressure was double what it was prior to the tea break. And one employee watched a concrete slab above the tank crack right as the emergency relief valve busted open and the pressure continued to go up, even though there was some atmospheric venting of the toxic MIC gas going on. So for the record, atmospheric venting just means letting it fly right into the air. That's just a fancy word for it's just coming out of the tank. There's no.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And that's not how it's supposed to happen. But there were at least three safety devices that should have mitigated that were malfunctioning, not in use, not big enough to handle this situation, or in some other way rendered inoperable.
Oh, my God. This fucking plant is doing everything wrong.
Everything.
The pressure has cracked concrete.
Yes.
Oh, no.
So one of these mitigating things was the refrigeration system, right? The refrigeration system is that should cool the tanks.
Mm-hmm. Let me guess, it was malfunctioning?
Well, it had been shut off because in January of 1992, there was some problems. So like 3 years prior. And so they removed the Freon. And since the system assumed refrigeration was happening, the temp alarm that was set to go off above certain temperatures had been disconnected because the temp was always fluctuating above the number that sets the alarm off because it's not being refrigerated.
I don't understand. Oh, my God. I don't understand.
It was just annoying, Amber. It was just annoying because that alarm was constantly going off.
Yeah.
The refrigeration wasn't working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my house is on fire. Let's take those fucking 9 volts out of that beep, 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 beep,
beeping. It's beeping and beeping.
God. Oh, so annoying. I'm trying to have my tea.
So even if the flare tower was still working, which it wasn't, it would not have been sufficient in size for a leak of this magnitude. And the vent gas scrubber that was deactivated at the time also would not have the capacity to stop a leak of that size, even if it was working either. But it wasn't. So
what is working here? The teapot is working. It sounds like the teapot works. The fuck?
Oh my God. I did not expect to laugh during this fucking story. I'm
sorry. This is ridiculous.
It's insane. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of that peanut dust guy.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. It's like, this is worse than the peanut factory.
Yes. That
peanut dust guy. I just started eating peanut butter again.
I'm here to remind you. So.
Oh, my God.
Okay, this is where it starts to get. In the span of 45 minutes to about an hour, about 30 tons of MIC gas escaped into the atmosphere. After 2 hours, it was about 40 tons. The gas was blown in a southeast direction right over Bhopal.
Oh, my God.
The alarm sounded in the factory at 12:50 a.m. And this is where I get so confused because it said, okay, so activating the system actually triggers two alarms, one inside the plant itself, the other external, to warn the general public and the city of Bhopal. But these two systems were not connected to each other, so they couldn't leave the factory warning siren on while the public one was on. So the public siren blared briefly at 12:50 a.m. and then it was turned off, as per company procedure, meant to avoid alarming the public around the factory over inconsequential leaks.
They turned the public warning off to avoid warning the public.
Yep.
Is that what you just said?
That's what I just said.
This is the stupidest company. I'm sorry. This is worse than Peanut Desk Guy.
Just wait.
Oh my God.
Meanwhile, the workers are leaving and they're traveling upwind, right? Around 1 a.m., the superintendent of police for Bhopal got a call from a town inspector who told him that residents in the Chola neighborhood, not far from the plant, were fleeing a gas leak. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of calls between 1:25 a.m. and 2:10 a.m. with the police talking to someone at the plant who told them, quote, everything is okay, and quote, we don't know what has happened, sir.
Then how do you know everything is okay?
Everything's fine.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here. With all this absolute lack of real communication, the Hamidiya Hospital, I think that's what it's called, was first told that the gas leak was suspected to be ammonia, then later phosgene. Eventually, someone told them it was MIC rather than use its name, methyl isocyanate, and the staff had no idea what MIC was, had no antidote for it, and no immediate information about it.
Why wouldn't the local hospital know exactly what that is?
This is an excellent question, Amber.
That's like not having a, like a, what's the thing when you've been bit by a rattlesnake in Arizona? Oh, I don't know what venom is or right. how to, like what? That's exactly what they should have there. Right. My God. The amount of failure is just, I've never heard of anything so ridiculous.
It's staggering.
Mm-hmm.
Around 2 a.m., the leak petered out, and around 2:15 a.m., the public siren was turned on for a period of time, and then a few minutes later, a factory employee walked into a police station to inform them of the leak, which was the first they had been told this by the factory, and also that the leak was plugged.
Okay.
Most of the city's residents who were exposed found out by being exposed or by opening their doors to find out what all the goddamn commotion was, none of them being instructed to shelter in place or evacuate. Oh. The first effects of exposure are coughing, severe eye irritation, a feeling of suffocation, burning in the respiratory tract, severe eyelid spasms. There's like a special word for that. I couldn't pronounce it. Breathlessness, stomach pains, and vomiting. People who had these symptoms fled from the plant. Those on foot fared much worse than those in cars. Because of their height, children and shorter residents inhaled higher concentrations because MIC is like twice as dense as air and falls towards the ground in an open environment.
Oh.
Thousands of people had died by the following morning. Primary causes of death were choking, reflexogenic circulatory collapse, and pulmonary edema, which is fluid in the lungs. Autopsies revealed changes not only in the lungs, but also cerebral edema, which is fluid on the brain, tubular necrosis of the kidneys, which is basically the death of the tubes that connect the kidneys to whatever they connect to, fatty degeneration of the liver, and necrotizing enteritis, which is death of the intestines.
Oh my God.
The ones who didn't die suffered from cancer, blindness, loss of livelihood, and financial strain.
Jesus Christ.
Laboratory simulations of the gas cloud determined there was likely a plethora of other chemicals in the gas cloud beyond MIC, including but not limited to chloroform, hydrogen chloride, and carbon dioxide, all either present in the tank or produced as a reaction to the water being added to the mix. And since almost all these gases were denser than air, the cloud stayed close to the ground as it spread out. Mm. And this happened in the middle of the night. So a lot of these people that got, that were injured and infected, they literally just happened to them while they were sleeping.
Yeah.
Like this this silent, deadly, like gas just seeped into their spaces and.
Mm-hmm.
In the immediate days following this disaster, the plant was closed to outsiders, including Union Carbide. The Indian government took over, but failed to make any information public. The chairman and CEO of Union Carbide, Warren Anderson, along with a technical team, traveled to India, but was placed on house arrest as soon as he arrived and urged by the Indian government to get the fuck out within 24 hours.
Good. Yeah.
Union Carbide did organize an international team of medical experts and brought in supplies and equipment to work with the local Bhopal medical community and begin assessing the cause of the gas leak. The healthcare system in Bhopal was out of its depths. Mm-hmm. In the very severely affected areas, most of the doctors were underqualified to treat the victims, and they were not prepared for thousands of casualties, and they had no awareness of the proper treatment for MIC gas inhalation. There were mass funerals and cremations. Within a few days, trees near the plant became barren and bloated animal bodies had to be disposed of. 170,000 people were treated at hospitals and temporary medical facilities. At least 200,000 children were exposed to the gases.
Oh my God. This is like the most massive thing I have ever heard of.
Yep. 2,000 buffalo, goats, and other animals were collected and buried. And then food got scarce because there were fears about the safety of their food, including fish, and fishing was prohibited. Mm-hmm. There was no other alternative. So on the 16th of December, the other two tanks were emptied of MIC by reactivating the plant and continuing to make the pesticide.
What?
And even with safety precautions such as water-carrying helicopters constantly circling the plant, there was still a second mass evacuation from Bhopal.
Are you kidding me? This is so... Oh, my God.
Eventually, formal statements came out that the air, water, vegetation, and food was safe, but still to stay away from the fish. Within weeks, the state government established a number of hospitals, clinics, and mobile units in the gas-affected area to treat the victims. S. Ravi Rajan, who was a professor of environmental studies at UC Santa Cruz, outlined the financially driven undertones of the company's actions. Union Carbide had participated in decades of previous instances of, quote, environmental negligence in every part of the world, directing its responsibility to its shareholders. And numerous dealings with local and international political and economic powers. The company's response to the Bhopal accident was what Rajan described as a, quote, campaign of erasure.
Wow.
Meaning the transfer of liability and responsibility of the cause of the gas leak, the event itself, and the aftermath. Rajan then argued that this type of response is to be expected according to the established cultural practice within large corporations such as Union Carbide.
This is just standard practice.
That's right.
Okay.
Since Union Carbide absolved itself from the situation, the Indian government was the next institution that was looked to by the people of Bhopal, but they had also not prepared for such an event. The government's attempts at short and long-term plans failed in successfully aiding victims and instead, quote, created an ecology of opportunity built largely at the expense of the victims. And of course, there were legal actions. Initial lawsuits were filed in the U.S. courts. And on April 17th of 1985, a federal district court judge overseeing one of the lawsuits suggested that, quote, fundamental human decency required Union Carbide to provide between $5 million and $10 million to immediately help the injured.
End yes.
quote. And he suggested the money could be quickly distributed through the International Red Cross. Side note. We've all learned over the last 10 or 20 years that the International Red Cross is full of fucking shady fuckery. And that was probably not
the best
avenue. No. So Union Carbide decided that they could offer some money this way to help based on the notion that doing so did not constitute an admission of liability. And so offered the Red Cross $5 million 2 days after this judge said this. And the Indian government turned down the offer. So then the case goes back and forth in U.S. courts until a U.S. district court ruled it should be transferred to India, which happened November of 1986. This was based on the fact that UCIL, Union Carbide India Limited, was a separate entity owned, managed, and operated exclusively by Indian citizens in India.
Mm-hmm.
The offer on the table at the time from Union Carbide was a $350 million fund that would generate somewhere between $500 and $600 million for victims. I don't know, like generate that much, like what they were going to do it in like a stock portfolio. I don't fucking corporations, man. The government of India refused this offer and they were claiming the victims were owed like $3.3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
The Indian Supreme Court was like, nah, you guys got to start over, clean slate, and figure this shit out. And when all was said and done, Union Carbide agreed to pay $470 million for damages caused, and they paid immediately. And this was February 1989. We are like 5 years out at this point.
Right.
Which, like, this is reminding me of the fucking Valdez oil spill bullshit.
Yep. Yeah. Let's just litigate the shit out of this. Meanwhile, people are... in need.
Literally, yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Throughout 1990, appeals came to the Indian Supreme Court on this settlement that were all dismissed. In October 1991, the Supreme Court ordered the Indian government to purchase out of that settlement fund a group medical insurance policy to cover up to 100,000 people who may later develop symptoms and cover any shortfall in the settlement fund. It also asked Union Carbide and UCIL to voluntarily fund a hospital in Bhopal at an estimated $17 million to specifically treat victims of the disaster.
Okay.
And the company agreed.
Well, that's good.
India attempted to try CEO Warren Anderson for manslaughter, but couldn't get him extradited from the U.S. to face those charges.
I was just about to ask, where's the criminal charges?
In June of 2010, seven former employees of UCIL, all Indians, most in their 70s, were convicted of causing death by negligence. These were like executives and management.
Mm-hmm.
They all got 2 years prison and like $2,800 in fines, and they were all released on bail right after the verdict.
What the fuck?
Someone tried to sue Union Carbide and Warren Anderson for crimes against humanity in the U.S. courts, but that lawsuit was dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm going to come at you with some staggering numbers.
Okay.
Some data about the health effects are still not available. The Indian Council of Medical Research was forbidden to publish health effect data until 1994, which is like 10 years later. A total of 36 wards were marked by the authorities as being gas affected, affecting a population of 520,000 people.
Oh my God.
Of these, 200,000 were below 15 years of age, and 3,000 were pregnant women. The official immediate death toll was 2,259, and in 1991, 3,928 deaths had been officially certified. The Sambhavna Clinic estimates 8,000 deaths during the first weeks and another 8,000 since then.
Oh my God. That's just like, I can't even wrap my head around the magnitude of this. 500,000 people. Oh my God.
Over 500,000 people.
Oh.
The government of Madhya Pradesh, that's the state where Bhopal is, confirmed a total of 3,787 deaths related to the gas release. Later, the affected area was expanded to include 700,000 citizens. A government affidavit in 2006 stated the leak caused 558,125 injuries, including 38,478 temporary partial injuries and approximately 3,900 severely and permanently disabling injuries. Tons of studies have been done over the decades to determine the real long-term health effects of this disaster, but they are hard studies to do. Some of the missing or insufficient fields for research are female reproduction, chromosomal aberrations, cancer, immune deficiency, neurological issues, PTSD, and children born after the disaster. That said, Bhopal now has high rates of birth defects and records a miscarriage rate of 7 times higher than the national average in India.
Holy shit. 7 times. My God.
Yeah. A 2014 report in Mother Jones magazine quotes a spokesperson for the Bhopal Medical Appeal, which runs free health clinics for survivors, as saying, quote, an estimated 120,000 to 150,000 survivors still struggle with serious medical conditions, including nerve damage, growth problems, gynecological disorders, respiratory issues, birth defects, and elevated rates of cancer and tuberculosis.
Oh my God.
The factory was closed in 1986, but all the shit is sitting there.
Still?
The isolation material is falling down and spreading. The whole area was used as a dump for like other hazardous chemicals.
Well, that's good. Just mix some more shit in there. See what happens.
That's right. That's right. The water around that area is still unsafe to drink and toxic to fish and has been an ongoing issue for those residents near the abandoned factory. I mean, we're talking decades later. Mm-hmm. Journalists over the years, as recently as 2010, have traveled there to photograph and document the site and have been hospitalized for the exposure to the chemicals there. The place is an ecological fucking nightmare.
Why is it still sitting there? Why?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, to some degree, it's like, it reminds me kind of like Chernobyl. Like, it, what are you going to do? You just have to stay away. Attempts to hold Union Carbide responsible for the ecological cleanup have been shot down by U.S. courts, claiming India's government is responsible, not Union Carbide. When you get into the nitty-gritty, Union Carbide tries to claim worker sabotage, asserting that some disgruntled employee put water in that tank on purpose. Well, everyone else is like, nah, you guys didn't give a fuck about safety and it was negligence. Literally, the information available on this disaster would have had us here for like an hour or more.
Oh my God.
There's and a ton off. Of, I right?
Fuck off.
Fuck right
that.
Off. There's a ton of activism around this locally. Soon after the accident, representatives from different activist groups arrived to join the local groups. The activists worked on organizing the gas victims, which led to violent repression from the police and the government. Every year, there's still actions, demonstrations, sit-ins, hunger strikes, marches, all the things. Often the marches end with burning an effigy of Warren Anderson.
Sorry.
I know. I was like, I kind of love that. To this day, Bhopal is considered the worst industrial disaster of all time. Yeah. With a confirmed 3,787 deaths and an estimated actual death toll of 16,000 and non-fatal injuries at over 500,000.
Oh my God. Jesus. And it still just sits there.
Yeah. I actually had this, I've had this on my list for a really long time. I watched a documentary, I want to say it was on Netflix, about this like a few years ago, and it was heartbreaking.
I bet.
Especially the part where like they kind of did some like dramatization moments, but they were like basically kind of giving you an like a visual of like this quiet, deadly gas just like low to the ground, just spreading over like neighborhoods where people were sleeping and stuff in the middle of the night. Just
it. Oh, God. That is terrifying.
And I also recall from that documentary, and I feel like I saw it in another article I was reading and I didn't write it in there, but at some point Union Carbide got bought out. Like Union Carbide doesn't exist as a company anymore. And whatever other big megacorp bought it is basically like, we had nothing to do with that, so we're not responsible for anything.
Yeah, so before my time, yeah.
Yep.
I just don't understand. I mean, capitalism. The heartlessness.
Capitalism ruins everything.
People. These are people. Oh my God.
So there you go, sister.
Thanks for that. They need their own Aaron Brockovich, it sounds like.
Yeah, right? No shit.
God damn it.
I know.
Well, I'm thoroughly bummed out now. Thanks for that.
Triple D. It's a triple D day.
Oh, God.
No, sister. I love you so much.
Love you so much.
I hope you get some rest tonight. Hey, you know what, Chaos Kids? We could really use some love. We're on the struggle bus. That was not a joke. I mean, it was hilarious at the beginning, but it was not a joke. So send us some love, man. Like, rate us on your app. Like, send us some love letters. Go write a review on your Apple podcast player and tell people why you listen to us. And, hey, go join the club so you can get in on the next virtual wine night. We had such a good time. Go to patreon.com/crimewineandchaos. $5 a month.
Five bucks a month.
You know what? If you're good listeners, you're boycotting Starbucks, you can afford $5 a month for us now.
So. Oh yeah, we already talked about this. Stop eating your avocado toast. Oh man. Oh, I love you.
Thank you, sister. Oh my God, that was so chaotic. So
chaotic. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye. Wine and Chaos is produced by 8th Direction Records. Artwork by Joshua M. Davis. Music by Paul Abner. If you would like to support the show, you can visit our Patreon page at crimewineandchaos.com/Patreon. Cheers.
Sister.
Yes.
Excuse me. The crying has got me all phlegmy.